Hello and welcome to the Sensemaking in a Changing World podcast. I'm Moray Gamble. Join me each week in conversation with leading ecological thinkers, activists, authors, designers, and practitioners to explore what now? What is the kind of thinking we need to navigate a positive and regenerative way forward? To myceliate possibilities, to explore what a thriving one planet way of life could look like. My guests offer voices of clarity and common sense. The Sensemaking and Changing World podcast is a project of the Permaculture Education Institute. We teach permaculture design, teaching and livelihood skills online to people on six continents, who in turn localise and enrich it and find appropriate ways to apply the planet care ethics of earth care, people care and fair share wherever they are. This episode is part of a special five-part Urban Agriculture Month series, and I'm speaking with Linda Appel-Lipsius, Executive Director of Denver Urban Gardens, a grassroots movement started in the late 1970s when a neighbourhood came together to create a space for local Hmong women to grow their own food. Now, Denver Urban Gardens oversees over 200 community garden spaces, over 34 acres in Denver, including 60 school-based community gardens and 19 community food forests, impacting tens of thousands of local Denverites. Linda is working to amplify the robust role that community gardens and food forests can play as critical infrastructure for thriving cities. In this special Urban Agriculture Month chat, we hear all about this amazing community garden program. I'm recording this episode from my hand-built solar-powered studio here on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country, surrounded by my permaculture design gardens in a permaculture village. Before we jump in, I'd love to invite you to subscribe to the Sensemaking a Changing World podcast on your favourite podcast app, and please do leave us a five-star review and a lovely comment. It does indeed help the bots to find our show. Well, let's now turn to the conversation with Linda Appel-Lipsius. Well, thank you so much for joining me on the show today, Linda. It's an absolute pleasure to have you here as part of our special Urban Agriculture series. So welcome. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Delighted to be here.
So I'm seated here at the moment on beautiful Gubbi Gubbi country here in Sunshine Coast of Australia, and I believe you're heading to Australia soon, but where are you now?
So I'm in Denver, Colorado, acknowledging the Cheyenne, Ute, and Arapaho tribes. Very much a big part of our gratitude for the work we do.
Yeah. We're going to talk about Denver Urban Gardens, Doug, soon, but before we go there, maybe you could just dive into a little bit about what drew you to working so deeply with community gardens and permaculture for the first instance. What led you to be in this space that you're in?
I always joke that most of my life is driven by a little bit of serendipity, but I guess serendipity happens for a reason. So I've been at Doug for just exactly 3 years. Before this, I ran my own business. So I had a tea company called Teatulia Organic Teas, and it was a B Corp, and we sourced our teas from a 3,000 acre regenerative organic tea garden in northern Bangladesh. So for the previous 16 years, I was very much in the regenerative ag space, impact business, B Corp's global, which is great. So using business as a force for good. And then, after 16 years and with COVID, I think as a lot of people were ready for a little bit of a pause and took some time. And then I was asked to join the board of Denver Urban Gardens. And then sort of some things happened and I ended up stepping in as interim part-time ED. And then 3 years later, I'm no longer interim or part-time. And it's been interesting. I may not sort of on the surface seem like there's a through line here, but, you know, I think it's the regenerative ag, the sort of power of growing your own food, connection to the earth, moving from a, you know, national or a global brand to hyper-local, you know, being in a role where people are, you know, right outside my door, you know, people are having, benefiting and impacting and connecting is really special. Regarding permaculture as well. So I took my PVC in 2018, and that was, you know, I was still at Teatulia, and that really, it changed my life. I mean, it was a 6-month course, and I call permaculture the lost language of hope. You know, I really felt like I was in this class. You know, I had two little kids. I get bored that quick. And yet I was able to sit for every single weekend because I felt like I was relearning You know, I was just sort of being, this knowledge was waking up in me, and it was so inspiring, and it has, you know, impacted everything I do. And then now in this role, you know, and I'll probably tell you later how we've really very much incorporated permaculture practices and principles into the work we do at Duck.
Oh, that's an amazing. I love how you describe permaculture. That's beautiful. And it does feel like that. And it does, I don't know, it touches a lot of people, as I've been speaking and saying, it touches on something about this inner, there's an inner yearning that perhaps we don't know is there until we actually start to face it and think, oh, that's it. That's the missing piece. That's what's helping to make me feel whole and to see the hope and the possibilities in front of us. So yeah. Thank you for sharing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Absolutely.
So you're at Duck, Denver Urban Gardens, and you talked about hyperlocal. You know, this is a hyperlocal project, isn't it? You're right there just in focusing on one city as your core, and within that a whole lot of series of different very hyperlocal projects. Maybe could you just describe a little bit more what you mean by hyperlocal, and then talk a bit about how Doug is facilitating that?
Yeah, I mean, as you know, in the conference we'll be focusing on around community gardens and you know, urban ag. My predecessor, you know, talked about land for the landless. It's a way for, you know, for city dwellers, apartment dwellers who can't, you know, access land to grow food. I think from a sort of benefit perspective, you know, and I can go into sort of all of our, you know, we look at these as a way to cultivate food community and climate resilience. It's a way for people to really, you know, get their hands in the dirt, to have a direct impact, to feel like they're part of something, not to feel like they're part of something, to be part of something, and to get to know your neighbors. I mean, I think, you know, the sort of hyperlocal impacts the food, you know, not only nutrient dense, because it's not schlepping from, you know, sort of the other side of the country over here, also tastes good, right? I feel like people don't focus enough on taste. It just tastes good. So, you know, the hyperlocal in that sense, I think the hyperlocal in terms of, you know, we don't know our neighbors anymore, you know, and we're starting to speak about community gardens as a third place, you know, so different, you know, the your office or your workplace, your home, our community institutions are disappearing, right? Communities of faith are disappearing. Community organizations are disappearing. And these community gardens are a way for you to get to know your neighbor who you just wouldn't anymore, right? People don't hang out on the street. So somebody who is a completely different socioeconomic background, from a different place, maybe, you know, a totally much older or much younger. And it's a way for people to come together with their neighbors in common cause, you know, for totally apolitical, you know, work. I was just speaking to my board member a little bit ago and talking about, you know, one of the great things at Doug is we're one of these nonprofits that we are nothing but good news. Like, it's just good news. And it's, you know, and it's climate action, but it's climate action in your neighborhood. It's climate action on your block. And at the end of the day, we can get all caught up in social media and what's happening on the other side of the world. But the only thing we actually really influence is our neighborhood and our community. So, so it's important. I think it's healing. I think it's, just really beautiful work.
Yeah. And, you know, I loved how you talked about it being, it's apolitical, but at the same time, it is so much about political engagement, like people engaging in place, people engaging in action that is about local and global simultaneously. And so that's a really interesting sort of contradiction in a way, that it's apolitical, but it is totally about people, you know, and bringing about a positive change and shifting the change in policies. Like, I mean, I've noticed this here in Australia as well, where community gardens getting started and doing this positive, hopeful, practical action on the ground is actually making political shifts because of the groundswell of movement. And so there's, you know, maybe it's a, I don't know, what's your experience over there in Denver, how you've noticed this groundswell of action shifting how policy takes place?
Yeah. I mean, in interesting ways. I mean, I think we're seeing, and I'm taking notes. That was a very interesting point. I think here we're, you know, in terms of policy, I think we're starting that conversation. I know in other cities across the country, it is really like it has landed. So like in New York City, they now have an office of Urban Ag, you know, so they really do. And the community garden organization there is part of the Parks Department. So there's different structures for a different community garden org. So we're, you know, we're a nonprofit. We're a little extra political just because an extra meaning outside, just because we sort of can play with everybody. But I do know that there's a lot of movement, you know, in the policy front in other places. I think we're really just trying to lead by example. Like one of the things that's happened that's kind of exciting is that we install community gardens and food forests on public land. So we work with parks, school districts, housing authorities, communities of faith as well. And we're installing a lot of food forests on parks land. And, you know, Denver Parks and Rec doesn't plant food trees, you know, because liability, I mean, all the things, all the reasons that, you know, and so the fact that we are able to install, you know, food trees on public land is really exciting. And as they're putting in place their forestry plan going forward, you know, it means maybe they're going to reconsider or look at, you know, ways to, yeah, just to add more food to the assortment.
I want to ask you about that. So you're talking about Denver having a forestry plan. So is this like a Denver urban forest concept that is being rolled out across the city for climate action, for resilience, for shade? What?
Yeah, so the forestry has always been part of parks, so it's not necessarily new, but the increased, it's definitely getting much more prominence now. So the Biden administration through the Inflation Reduction Act has, and I can't remember, it's billions of dollars are going towards building the canopy and going towards forestry initiatives. So they just dispersed money and attended. I think they mostly pick municipalities. So there is just so much extra funding now going towards forestry departments and tree initiatives. And it is stunning. So, right. So it's a department of, you know, Denver. It has really been focused on shade trees. But we're seeing, you know, we're starting to see, I think, an interest and a curiosity around and acknowledging that food trees aren't, you know, we don't provide the canopy in the same way, but there's other benefits, obviously, you know, that come with it. So, yeah.
I think it's really interesting to notice where those movements are in policy shifts or where there is pockets of funding to be able to tie in the work that happens in community gardens, because often it flies under the radar so much, and, you know, running by the, you know, the smell of an oily rag, just trying to make stuff happen. And when you can align with major programs and just have a, like a slight tweak, like doors open and
yeah,
just recently received a grant, haven't you, for some work that you're doing?
Yeah. And this is only about a week old. So I'm still processing it. So Doug went after an EPA grant. So the Environmental Protection Agency. So it's $500,000 grant over 3 years. This is the first time Doug has received EPA funding.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Oh, I'm thrilled. I'm beyond thrilled. Like this is one of the most exciting things, I think. Well, certainly that's happened to me since we've been here, or since I've been here. And this is, it's exciting because Doug has really been thought of as, you know, as food, which it is, and that's great. But we've really been evolving our positioning to cultivating food, community, and climate resilience. And you, I don't know if you find this too. People are like, community gardens aren't climate. And you're like, okay, yes, they are. We're healing the soil. We're increasing biodiversity. We're increasing the tree canopy. We're, you know, carbon capture, water, like all the things are happening here. Again, hyperlocal, even though it's on a small scale, it matters for that community, right? The temperature is still lower. The biodiversity, the oxygen content is still higher, you know, in these spaces. And so, yeah, so the EPA gave us this grant focusing on the West area in Denver, which is a historically redlined, you know, no grocery stores, the green spaces, like appallingly low. And the other piece of it that's really exciting is that the plan that this West area put in place, very community driven. And when they put it in place, they flipped it on its head. So most of these area plans are development driven. They said, nope, well-being measures go up to the top, guys. And so these well-being measures align with the work we do. So we're just really excited to sort of focus in on that area where the community has already raised this, to really work in partnership with the community and other organizations, because we can't, you know, we alone can barely, you know we can't move the needle, but work with forestry, work with the other urban ag orgs to really make a difference.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so tell me how Doug actually works. Like, how does it fit? Because you've talked about lots of different projects that are going on and lots of different aspects of it. How does the organization itself function and help to facilitate the kind of action that you're seeing going on in urban agriculture in Denver?
Yeah, so Doug has been around about 45 years. At this point, we are one of the largest independent community garden organizations in the country. So we operate 200 community gardens and 20 food forests across 7 counties. And the way that it works in our program areas, we have gardens and food forests, what we call food access, which is we distribute pay what you can seeds and seedlings. And then there's our education piece. On the garden and food forest, which is obviously the biggest part of what we do, the community comes to us, you know, and the demand far exceeds what we're able to build, comes to us. They've identified a space. There's a critical mass of people who are interested. And then we work together, usually over, you know, 1 to 3 years, to identify the space, to design the garden, you know, to co-create that with the community. Always have to come up with money to do it. And then we build it. And we build it using doing through volunteer work days. So it's a really beautiful way to engage the community in the work. And when we engage, you know, the actual folks who are going to be doing the garden, they have a real sense of ownership, you know, in the space. And then once it's up and running, we always say our secret sauce at Doug is the human infrastructure. So we support a network of about 350 volunteer garden leaders who, you know, we support the garden leaders and the garden leaders support the gardens. It's really a nice distributed model that lets us scale, but also, you know, ensures that we have real local representation and support.
How do you support the garden leaders? What's that look like?
So we have a series of events throughout the year. So we kick it off with a symposium, and then we have training. We have a lot of classes. We have meetups, workshops, learning labs throughout the year. We actually, I think it was 2 years ago, we put in place what we call the Doug Corps. So it's a seasonal workforce that supports the leaders even more on the ground. So, hey, you know, what do you need? What training do you need? How can we support you with new gardeners? How can we support you in doing events, you know, either within the garden or inviting the community in? So that's been a really nice addition. Something that we do, and I'm sure you've seen this, that I don't know, it's always interesting, is we do mediation, right? When the gardeners fight with each other, which they do, you know, we have a process for that. And our goal is really to provide enough of a sort of backbone and infrastructure so that the garden leaders, they're really focusing on building community and growing food. We handle the gardener registration. So we, you know, if there's 20 gardeners at a, you know, at a garden, we do online plot apps. They come to us. We track them in Salesforce. We collect the plot fees and then distribute them out to the gardens. And that's a huge lift off the shoulders. It's kind of a pain in the butt, we always say, but I think it's really been very important to the sustainability of our network, because that piece is so, it's just a pain, you know, and especially like, there's just so many ways that it can go wrong or people can lose track. And so doing all of that back office support is something that I think is incredibly important.
Look, it's so amazing. And I can just see how, you know, replicating or adapting that model in so many other places would be just brilliant, because each one of those separate little gardens that are everywhere have to hold that all by themselves as a volunteer group. And it's so, so much. And also just for the leaders to feel supported and enabled and opportunities for education. That's fantastic.
Oh, and just the last thing is that they're part of a group, right? They're part of a bigger whole, which I think is something that's so important too, is that they've got peers to lean on. They've got mentors.
Yeah, no, that's great. Absolutely. And I think that learning community and all those things like the learning labs and the symposiums and all that holding of the space to create that learning culture. I think it's fantastic. What I was going to ask you was how does Dope support itself to offer those services across the region? What's the nuts and bolts, these kind of stuff behind the scenes?
So we have a team of, I think at this point, we're about 22 staff. The staff is, you know, distributed across those programs, but also operational staff and, you know, fundraising, marketing, grants management. I've really been focusing on sort of diversifying our funding. There's private foundations. You do get a lot of government grants. So we talked about the EPA grant, but one of our sort of other large funders, the city of Denver, it's called Healthy Food for Denver's Kids. Our largest funders, we're also actually the Scientific and Cultural Council in Denver, gives us funding too. So there's a lot of municipal funding sources, but a really nice opportunity that's emerged in the last couple of years is corporate support. So we get corporate grants, but we also started a garden adoption program. So we work with mostly Main Street, mostly local businesses who adopt gardens. They have a 3-year contract, $2,500 a year. And it's just been a really nice way to sort of, you know, connect the community with the gardens. It gives us, you know, it's a really nice, you know, sort of reliable, you know, repetitive sort of revenue stream as well. Yeah.
I mean, that's amazing. And I think that diversified stream of possibilities brings in that the stability in the structure. And is it run as a social enterprise? Is it run as a, like, what's the actual legal kind of structure that you have set up to facilitate? Yep.
So we're a 501c3 nonprofit. So we're not a lobbying organization. You know, it just gives us all that nonprofit status. And just FYI, my background, I have a business background. I think you do that. But yeah, so up until this point, and it's been really interesting because people are sort of like, hey, how's it to run a nonprofit? I'm like, it's a business, just like any other business. It's just a different tax status. You still have to balance the books. You still have to, you know, there's still sales, marketing, you know, all the things that happen, you know, in any other entity. So it's just been great. And I think, you know, just different dynamics, different rhythms, but, you know, that's the same in any industry or sector.
Yeah. So before we switched on the mics, you were telling me about how you did your PDC, and you mentioned that earlier, but you mentioned too about how it has changed how the Dove Gardens operate. How have you seen that influence myceliate across the projects?
Yeah, I mean, we have a lot of permies. I think, gosh, at this point, it's almost maybe over half the team has actually taken the PDC. Which is really great. And so, I mean, a couple of things, the most just obvious is that two years ago, we launched the Food Forest Initiative. And so we are now, up until this point, Doug was only doing in-ground annual vegetable beds. And then we started doing, you know, essentially community orchards, but very much the food forest methodology. So that's been amazing. And it benefits the organization because it just adds dimensionality to our work. It also attracts a lot of interest, especially like I was saying about the canopy. And then the principles. I mean, we live in a desert, you know, Denver's the high desert, Colorado. And, you know, the survival rate of trees on a good day is not amazing here just because it's such a harsh environment. So planting in guilds and companion planting, you know, we're really, really hopeful that sort of extra level of resiliency and redundancy is really going to help, you know, make these food forests a success. So that's one. Another area that's been really delightful is, you know, at the end of the season. So our growing season is March to October. Up until a couple of years ago, you know, at the end of the season, you put the garden to bed and you clear it. And we are shifting away from that, right? You don't do that. You take away disease material, that's fine, but you leave it in ground, you keep, and then really acknowledging that so much work is happening during the winter in healing the soil. We started promoting cover crops. We started promoting season extension, you know, all of these things that, you know, we got from permaculture. And then even just the garden practices, you know, it was always organic, you know, practices anyway, but very much bringing in, you know, much more, you know, mulch and sort of many more permaculture and regenerative principles.
Yeah. And how has that translated across all the different projects? Because some of them, as you're saying, well, most of them before were the in-ground annual beds. Are you noticing that they're starting to take on more of these practices as well? Like, how's that transition going on?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think much more, you know, around cover crops and mulching. And I think more and more people are interspersing pollinators in their, you know, in their vegetable beds. And there's many more pollinator gardens coming in. You know, composting is a big piece of what we do. We actually run the Master Composter Program for the city of Denver. And really bringing, you know, the gardens have had sort of a, you know, hit or miss a little bit with composting in the gardens, but much heavier emphasis on that and much heavier support really from, you know, along this environmental justice threat, like, you know, just healing the soil and creating sort of a, you know, full circle. So it's definitely been weaving its way into everything we do. It's run through here too. So,
Yeah. I was just going to ask you about the education piece. So from a permaculture education perspective, because that's kind of what we focus on here, is just wondering how deeply it runs. So there's a PDC, but, you know, does it get woven into the learning labs or other programs as well, in terms of just different types of education programs that are permaculture related?
Yeah. So the PDC in the last, I think starting last year, their culminating project was a Doug Garden. So the students were actually able to put the principles in practice, have hands-on work days. So not just, you know, sort of conceptual, but they were actually able to bring the project to life. In terms of sort of deeper permaculture and, you know, teacher training, we haven't done that yet. But, you know, really hoping to do that. Also hoping to add more sort of social permaculture and, you know, even what I get really excited about doing is little mini PDC courses, just introducing the concepts and the principles to a much broader audience. I also love the idea of introducing permaculture principles into business. Yeah. So I keep getting after Creighton and the folks who run the PDC here. I'm like, guys, like, let's go to the business community and introduce this, you know, just systems way of thinking. So yeah, I think there's so much opportunity.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds fantastic. You know, like a little mini PDC for the local architects, a mini PDC for local government offices. Like, you could take it to every field, for the health professionals. You know, I think that's kind of what, you know, really, really needs to happen in so many ways, because it's a lens, isn't it? Really, like, you can apply that lens, that permaculture lens, to whatever it is that you're doing. Yeah.
Yeah. I also have to put out there, I do have a garden. I'm not the most skilled gardener, so I'm very much applying this in systems ways, you know, and I think it's just important for people to know, like, there's so many ways you can apply this. It doesn't necessarily have to be like growing the best veggies, which
exactly,
I'm not.
So exactly. Yeah. It's looking at how all of us can contribute with all the skills and knowledge and experience we bring to be imagining what it is that we can be working forwards to and actually putting it into practice. So yeah, it takes all those skills. I wanted to ask to the school gardens, because I know there's probably a lot of people who are listening to this who are also really interested in how that works. We've got a bit of a school garden movement here in Australia, and it has its ups and downs and roundabouts. I wonder what's your experience with the school gardens that are involved in your in the Doug programs.
Yeah, so we have, it's about 75 of our gardens are school-based community gardens. And that's a really important difference. We run our school gardens as community gardens on school property. The school gets a third to a quarter of the plots if they want it for programming. Anybody who gardens in a school-based community gardens has to have a background check. That's the model. And unfortunately, with COVID, a lot of the school gardens dropped off. And so we're really... And the gardens are still there. It's more, let me rephrase that, the school involvement has dropped off. And so we're going to be really doubling down on that next year to reintroduce the schools to the gardens. That being said, we have a handful who are highly engaged, who use the gardens as outdoor classrooms. And one of the really nice things about the school-based community gardens too, is it really knits together the community and the school. You know, so in the summer, the community gardeners are caring for the school plots. You know, they really get to know each other in a nice way. A number of the gardens also have a garden and cafeteria program, so they're able to grow for the cafeteria, which is nice. And then another actually really fun fact is the Denver Public Schools, which is our largest school district here, has this youth sustainability group. We actually just honored them at our gala. They're the first in the country that has established this youth climate action. And they install the sustainability pillar in the public school charter. And actually, the Vice President Kamala Harris was out here a couple months ago to meet with them. I mean, it's really, really so exciting what they've accomplished. And so we're strengthening our partnership with them as well.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. I wonder whether there's the community gardens. I love the fact that you're talking about community gardens in the schools, and that's weaving it together rather than it's like school gardens, community gardens over here. I wonder how much the food forest idea, the community orchards, is coming into the schools as well. Is that piece?
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, they want them. Yeah, it's really great. We've installed already. Of the 20. I think maybe 5 or 6 are on school property. And the really neat thing we were talking about too is most of them are elementary schools. So the kids are able to install and be involved in the food forest when they start. And then when they come back, I mean, it's a legacy project. So it's something that they're going to be part of and that they're going to be able to see grow and, and take advantage of it, you know, unlike the gardens that are just a little bit different rhythm. So the schools are really, really eager and interested. And the schools here are, I mean, they're one of the biggest landowners in the city. So, and this land isn't being used, right? It's turf and they have to mow it and water it. So we're trying to help them do that or convert.
It's amazing. It sounds phenomenal what you're doing. And I'm really curious to hear, you know, just like how big is Denver overall? And like, how much does this sense of urban agriculture feel part of the culture of the place?
Oh gosh, in terms of specifics, I cannot get that to you at the end of the day.
No, that's all right. Sorry.
We're sort of a medium-sized city.
Okay, that's good enough. Yeah.
I'm like, I don't know. And, you know, urban ag here is, I mean, it's growing and it's interesting to see, you know, also the interplay with the hydroponic and all the indoor ag that's happening, which totally has its place. And I think it's really exciting to see so much of this come up. It's definitely growing. And I think the awareness of it, you know, is it necessarily single-handedly going to transform the food system? Unfortunately, probably not. Is it going to make a dent? Is it going to connect people to their food? So where I get really excited about this work, though, is that you're growing, you know, organic, you know, regeneratively grown food for the first time. You taste it, you have the experience. It means then when you go into the food system, you're going to be supporting regenerative producers, right? It's this sort of trickle-up effect that this has on the food system. So if it makes us all sort of more aware, sort of more activist consumers, that's great, right? So if we're able to influence a larger scale producer. So it exists. There's a number of farms and operations, you know, around town. It's growing, the interest is growing, the awareness is growing for sure.
The trickle up, I think that's so powerful, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh yeah.
I was ask you whether you, like, since you've been working with Doug, is there something that's been like this just really blown your mind or has been so inspiring, like a particular moment or a particular project that just stands out for you as being, oh my gosh, that is just phenomenal?
I think just the stories that you hear about how people's community gardening experiences really change their lives. We've got, and I can send you the link to this video. It was produced soon after I got here, but, you know, interviewing, you know, a guy in a garden up the street here, you know, is a veteran, PTSD, and, you know, and this garden, you know, this connection, this purpose, this really transformed his life. And I think in this video, there's another, I mean, there's just sort of all of these case studies of people. And, you know, like everybody, it's just, you find this sense of connection. I mean, my personal story is actually kind of fun. So I live downtown, in downtown Denver, and I have a rooftop garden, but we built a new garden right downtown by my house. And so I joined it. I'm like, hey, I'm ready, you know, I should experience this. I've lived downtown for almost 17 years and I live in, it's like a brownstone. So I actually don't really have like neighbors or people I see in the elevator so much, but I met more people in my 6 months at this community garden than I had in this. I know I might be antisocial, but it was so incredible that this just broke down the barriers. It gave everybody a reason to talk to each other. I felt so much more part of my community than I had in the previous 16 years. So that just showed me kind of firsthand how impactful this is. the pride of place, you know, the curiosity of the neighbors coming by. And it really felt like it was bringing people together in a way that just the rolling green grass was not doing. So that had been there before.
Yeah, that's hugely powerful, isn't it? And I've had similar experiences to that too. And similar stories in all the projects that, you know, here in Australia, it's phenomenal. And, you know, something that Sustain Australia has done a lot of research about is about that, the mental health positive benefit of community gardens, because, you know, like you were saying before, you know, community gardens are often seen as the food bit, but there's all these other pieces, like you were saying, the climate piece and the mental health piece. And so we're seeing a lot of funding coming through in Australia through the health departments to support. I wonder whether that's also something that you're noticing in Denver, that the health support for community gardens.
Oh, big time. Yeah. And I think on a national scale, I don't know if it's gotten out there, but the Surgeon General in the United States declared an epidemic of loneliness. And it is, if look it up, it's actually fascinating, because he's saying that loneliness and isolation increases rates of heart disease, stroke, all of these like actual mortality, morbidity, you know, factors massively, like 60-70%, like more than a chain smoker. It is so detrimental to your health. And, you know, he's declaring this epidemic of loneliness. And we actually just published a study in the Lancet medical journal in January. It was a result of a 3-year randomized study that looked at the mental and physical health benefits of community gardening specifically. Yes, increased fiber intake, amazing. That's great. We, you know, so good. But where it was really exciting was the reduction in depression and anxiety. And I think that's something that is just, you know, bringing your neighborhoods together, getting people off phones. You know, you feel so much better when you, even if you walk down or water your plants, like you feel so much better. And then there's another thing that we're looking at from this study too, that's just delightful. You know, and you've probably seen some of this, is that yes, your neighbors are depending on you, but your plants are depending on you. And like, you know, and the sort of every human like wants to be needed. Right. And so like this sort of mutual dependence that happens in a garden is just, it's so healing and therapeutic that it's yeah.
Yeah. If the Surgeon General has announced this, has it trickled down to actually the medical profession prescribing, go and join your local community garden?
I just presented to a group of med students yesterday. We're laughing. So not really. I don't want to disrespect them. No, I don't think so yet. Although, it is starting. These green scripts, these social scripts are starting to come up. I think where community gardening is interesting is that if you give a script to a community garden, it's sustained, it's reliable, it's something that, you know, can be habit forming instead of a one-off that you may or may not use. It's starting.
Yeah, well, that's a great opening, I think, when you have the Surgeon General saying that, and it gives a possibility for actually accessing maybe some greater level of support. If there's organizations like Doug that can take some of that back end challenge of running a community garden smoothly, and that there was more community gardens, just get on with community gardening and the social permaculture side of it, and more organizations like Doug that can take and hold the admin side of it, it would actually help to make many more ripple out, I think, because I think one of the things that makes it harder is just getting it started and keeping it going. You know, that takes effort. And I wonder whether you could speak to maybe some of the challenges that some of the groups face. And, you know, are there some that start and fail, or why is that, and how you're able to help them? Because, you know, it happens, doesn't it?
Oh yeah. Yeah. And actually that is something that it's sort of in its early stages, but we've launched the Urban Garden Project, we call it, which is just that. It's like, how can we support other organizations across the country so that they can, you know, get to a level of, you know, surviving and thriving. You know, I mean, the challenge is, so we started these, and actually Naomi, she calls into these calls sometimes, and we have these national calls, these quarterly national calls, where people are talking through, you know, I don't like to say challenges, they're talking through their opportunities. And, you know, it's all the way from, you know, land acquisition, you know, protecting, you know, the rights to the land, water, especially with climate change. I mean, it's just becoming brutal. You know, volunteers, how do we all handle volunteers? Obviously funding, you know, it's a never ending. But yeah, I mean, I think there's everyone, you know, and these are some of the more established organizations, but, you know, we met at the ACGA, which is a national conference. I remember this group of gardens, I mean, I think it was like 10 gardens in North Carolina. And they're like, you know, we're really trying to find a way to establish the gardens in more, you know, just higher impact areas, but they couldn't figure out how to do that. Right. And so there's so many different models that I think people may not be aware of. There's so many, you know, we have land use agreements, we have insurance, you know, sort of like templates that people can use that and then we have this back office, the sales, you know, with this whole Salesforce tool that the goal is ultimately that we offer this. And then we're sort of able to license this to other organizations to do just that so that they can just focus on that. There's a big around succession planning. You know, we can support with succession planning, which I think is probably one of the biggest challenges for gardens is you're really excited and then you move or you get bored. And how do we keep it going?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that, you know, what you just responded there is really about being in conversation at a bigger scale than just your one garden. So you're part of a network and your networks are part of networks, and the conversation of sharing and collaborating and you know, that's where the answer is, isn't it? It's being
yes,
in conversation.
Which is why I'm so excited to come and see you guys.
Yeah, so you're about to come to Australia and you're coming for the Urban Agriculture Forum. And then I believe you've also got a whole tour organized for you. Do you know where you're heading? It's a big, big adventure down under.
Oh my gosh, I'm going to be in, and if I'm saying I'm wrong, I'm sorry, I'm going to be in Canberra, Brisbane, Melbourne, and Sydney.
Pronounced perfectly. Yes.
Oh, good. Fantastic. So doing a series of talks, and I've, you know, we met Naomi last year when she was here on tour with the Churchill Fellowship, reading her report, and just, you know, that's been so inspiring seeing that, you know, global perspective. So I'm so excited to just come to her and come to you guys and see, you know, what's happening.
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much for joining me today on the Sense Making the Change in World podcast. And I will see you in Sydney. It's really inspiring. I have to say, it's so uplifting, and I just feel there is so much possibility in this space, and I really would love to encourage so many people to get involved. I mean, as a final thing, how do you encourage people to get involved in community garden project? What's the way that you invite people to come and play?
I love that, to come and play. I mean, we probably through volunteer work days, you know, our gardens usually have wait lists. So we want people to join a garden, but if not, come to work days or come to the lesson, you know, the classes, and just, you know, just work yourself into the, you know, into the community.
Yeah. Oh, I like that. You don't have to start with a garden. You just work your way into it. Yeah. Just find your way to connect. Yeah.
Exactly.
Thank you for your time today. I know it's the end of your day here, and it's been a big time with all the things that are going on, and obviously too getting ready for being away from the place for some time. So I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, thank you for your interest. This was a pleasure and an honor.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Sense Making in a Changing World. Check out the show notes below to find the link to Denver Urban Gardens and all the resources they have available there. Also, too, this is where you'll find details of all of our permaculture courses, our permaculture YouTube, blog, and free masterclasses and permaculture film clubs. Make sure you signed up, too, to hear all of the news and updates. And come and join us at the Permaculture Education Institute to learn practical skills for designing and teaching permaculture and making a good livelihood while living a permaculture-inspired, one planet way of life. Take care, everyone. See you soon.